We're now in a working session of the Finance Administration and Oversight Committee. Again, in a working session, no votes are taken, so we're looking at what things we can possibly do with the budget. So far, we've made remarkable progress. We've gotten our situation so that we can actually see the light at the end of the tunnel. And we are at a point where it looks like we might be able to very soon come up with a balanced budget that we can approve, and or at least get to public hearing on whatever issues are still left. So, Mr. General Manager, Ms. Bissell.
Yes, we'd like to first, Mr. Chair, we'd like to go through the budget crosswalk as we like to describe it. I think we will get this up on the board, and I'm going to ask Carol Kissel to go through the point up to the recommended service adjustments.
Last budget work session, we actually were able to reduce the budget gap down to a $29 million, $28.8 million level. As a result, we actually carved out $44 million based upon some direction the committee had provided to us. And I can run those down specifically. They were in fiber optic revenue, revenue for paper transfers, expense reductions in the GASB 45, expense reductions in purchase services, and Fed funding to move funding over to preventive maintenance, as well as some pension adjustments, wage settlement adjustments. And in addition, we came up to a total of $44 million. So we're at the $28.8 million level now. What we can do is we can there were some questions that the board asked us, the committee asked us specifically to go through, which was the subsidy allocation by jurisdiction. I have those charts, so the next couple of pages we can go through that, and then we can come back to the recommended service adjustments of $21 million. Would that be okay?
Certainly.
Chair? Okay. So on the next page, we actually put this page because if there was a subsidy increase based upon the gap that we had of $73 million, we just wanted to show how the allocations were set. And really, this is just a gentle reminder that the subsidies are obviously formula-driven, as you know, Metro Rail, Metro Bus, and then non-regional bus, and they're based upon population and density. And this is how it would have looked if that $73 million would have to be driven by a subsidy increase. The next page actually shows the $29 million that we're dealing with, which is the gap. And what we've shown on this page actually is the what the subsidy increase would have been by each jurisdiction if this remaining gap was not closed. We were asked that question at the last week's meeting, and we provided that information here. On the next page, we actually we were asked about the $28.8 million budget gap, and when we looked at the service adjustments in terms of bus service, headways, and mezzanine closings, the question the committee asked us was to actually show what that subsidy would look like by jurisdiction. We actually have laid out that $29 million by the jurisdictions. The goal was to maintain the subsidy levels for 2009, obviously the minimum impact to the customers.
I do have a question on this one. The asterisk?
Actually, because the above three were subsidy-driven, the additional plug, if you will, to get to neutral subsidy had to be just that, a plug. And as a result, when we plug that in, the way we can plug it is really in just non-regional service, since that is 100% subsidized and controlled by the jurisdictions. If we put it a plug in any other of the categories, it would have, it's like stepping on Jell-O. It would have then parsed out to each of the other jurisdictions and increased or decreased their subsidy. So we just plugged it into non-regional to show you what it looked like.
Can I see if I understand it? If I go to the previous table, the district had a $4.9 million amount out of the $2.9 million. Is that right? That's the starting point for this last piece?
Yes, that's correct.
And if you did the service reductions that you've already proposed, the district would actually end up at a credit. You would have cut more than they needed to get to zero.
That's correct.
But for everybody else, we still would have to do cuts.
That's correct.
Okay.
Right.
So that says that pretty much the district has a $5 million problem. Maryland has got about a $15 million problem, $16 million problem, and that's the way we interpret it. If we do what you had proposed, it would be that bottom line, and the district, in fact, would have money left over.
Yes, they would. They would have the $2.9 million that they could choose to.
And since I'm primarily interested in Maryland, we'd be looking at about $8 million that we would have to cut if we did the other things that you suggested.
That's correct.
That's the correct interpretation of this chart?
That's the correct interpretation.
Okay. Are there any other questions?
Now, the next set of charts, actually, we get to some of the specific questions that were asked of this committee. The first question, actually, was the use of the stimulus funding that we anticipate receiving from the stimulus bill. The question specifically was dollars available to be used for preventive maintenance? And the question is answered that we actually, on the bottom bullet there, that those funds are 100% allowable for preventive maintenance expenses. And just to remind the committee, the pool of preventive maintenance committee on the operating side is well in excess of over $400, maybe $500 million. It's really the steady state of repair parts that we use, that we don't capitalize, that we use in operating expenses. So the pool is large enough, and the funds are eligible for that use.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I was asked this question last night from one of the board members, the chairman from the District of Columbia. Could you use the monies from the stimulus package to fund sufficient preventative maintenance to cover the $30 million in the gap? And the answer to that question is yes, you could do that. But understand that the stimulus monies is a one-year stimulus package. So I just wanted to answer the question. Could you do it? Yes, you can do it. It would be a board decision. But again, it's a one-year package, and the funding would not be there next year.
So it would leave a $30 million hole in next year's budget that we would have to fix right in the beginning.
For the 2011 budget. But it will address the 2010.
But there's 2 years of stimulus.
Well, the total amount, yes, there are 2 years of stimulus.
I remember the 2 years.
Are you referring to the fact that it could be spent over a two-year period?
Or you could have the same amount.
That's correct.
You might be thinking about 20. Excuse me for just blurting out. But you may be thinking about 2012.
If you do that, though, keep in mind that you've done two things. One, you've created a problem for a future year. And number two, you get into a situation where when we have a $12 billion capital need, we've just taken $60 million out of that we could otherwise have spent on maintenance or rehabilitation and replacement that we already know we want to be able to do. And I would note, one of the things that was pretty obvious from these other tables is we're within striking range of potentially solving this problem without doing that. So that might be an approach. Yes, sir, Mr. Graham.
Well, I think your last argument is the most compelling. Let's hope that is, in fact, the case. But the situation is, I mean, I think there are two assumptions which I have to make in order to get up in the morning, and that is that the world economy is going to get better, that we are not going to sink deeper and deeper into recession, depression, and everything else, that there are rosier days ahead, number one. And number two, I absolutely assume that we are going to have the dedicated funding, and that we are going to figure out a way to get $3 billion over 10 years into the system. And so, as you point out, Mr. Benjamin, and accurately so, you know, there's a little bit of a roll of the dice here, but when we compare it to the types of drastic service reductions that we have on the table, and allowing for the possibility that we really must do it, you know, I'm inclined to go that way than the service reductions.
Mr. Albert?
So I think I'm inclined to go not that far with the stimulus, but to actually put the stimulus dollars into play. I noticed that your staff have been working at least for the last 6 weeks, or to 2 months, on trying to get to a bottom line on this. But I do agree with Mr. Graham that if we look at the economy the way it is and today, and today only, and build our budget on that scenario, then we shouldn't use the subsidy at all. Just leave it for the dire maintenance needs that we have. But I think we've got to try and strike a reasonable balance between being optimistic that the economy will somehow turn around within the next 2 years, at least that's my role that I play in my day-to-day life, and recognizing that there's some urgent maintenance needs that need to be addressed. I'm not suggesting we use the entire $30 million, Mr. Graham, but some portion of it so that we minimize the impact, negative impacts on hardship on riders, on staff, and folks that really will be impacted in a very dreadful way if we go through with the cuts that are proposed today.
If I may comment, Mr. Albert, one of the things that got us down to $28 million was to increase the amount of preventive maintenance, which effectively does what you're just talking about. We could either put that money back in 2 years after the stimulus package is over, or we could let it continue to be a draw on the capital budget after that. But we've already done almost $10 million worth of that in getting to the point that we are right now. Mr. Graham.
Yeah, I just want to, I agree with Mr. Albert. But the I do want to also add that the $11 billion, which we anticipate needing in the next 10 years, am I right?
Yes.
Am I right? Already has a $4 billion shortfall. Mm-hmm. Am I right?
Yes.
So, you know, you reach a point where you begin to wonder just how important is $30 million in that scheme, and I just add that as an additional argument that people need to keep in mind.
I hear you. Keep in mind that 4 billion shortfall is after the 3 billion that you were talking about.
Yes. Right? Yes. No. Understood.
Even after that, we
right. And assuming Metro Matters continues robust and so on, with all of that, there's still a $4 billion shortfall.
Shall we continue? And then I think I'd like to make a proposal, having looked at all of this material, when we get to the end and see where everybody is. Could you go on to the next one, please?
Okay. The next question that we actually had from the committee last week was to look at parking specifically on the weekends. And actually, we have a chart that we mailed out in this package that looked at parking, but we have an updated chart to show you on the screen today that really just looks at the parking revenue assumptions and expenses. The one change of the chart that you have in your books, we made assumptions on what we thought were losses on rail revenue that we would have as a result of the parking on the weekends. It's really, we're not comfortable with the assumption because we don't know. It was based on some price elasticity analysis that was done in the 80s, and as a result, I'm not recommending that we're comfortable with that analysis. So what I wanted to show you was what I think we know, which is revenue assumptions, and what we do know, the expense that we would incur if we had parking on the weekends. What we've done is on the revenue, we've assumed a $2.50 and a $3 parking on weekends for Saturday and Sunday. As you can see, our parking capacity currently on weekdays is about 88%. That's about 57,000 spaces that are filled. We made the broad assumption that we would get 25% utilization on the weekends, which I would add is very high. I think we had done based upon the committee's recommendation, we had some eyes on the ground last weekend and had looked at some areas of garage use, and our staff came back with a 7% utilization number, and we have, you know, where that analysis was done. But that being said, we have 25% here, so it's a high assumption. Based upon that, and based upon the price of $2.50 and $3, you can see the annualized number in terms of contribution to revenue. The expense on the other side is a pretty simple expense, is just the cost of having LAS parking at those facilities in manned, which would be a 1.7. So the net of that would be the increase in revenue. Now, that being said, I think that there's a lot of assumptions. The utilization is probably high, as well as I have no information to predict the loss in rail revenue currently, so we haven't predicted that.
Madam Chair, if I might, just to reemphasize that, again, this assumption is 25%. We only had numbers from one weekend, and it shows that at 9%, we need to do additional weekends to make sure that was not an odd weekend. But the number is probably going to be less than 25% utilization. So these numbers are just what if versus based upon any facts yet.
And the other thing that I just heard you say is, although in the original material you did do an estimate of decrease in rail utilization, that's not included here, so you have to subtract that out as well.
Yeah, we wanted to exclude it because I'm not quite sure what that is, and we based it on some trend data that we had that was dated material. So,
but at this point, I personally, looking at this and saying I think there will be a substantial reduction in rail revenue, I don't see enough revenue coming out of this to create that kind of impedance to our major function, which is to provide mobility and to get people to ride the system on weekends. Mm-hmm. We've been very successful on our weekend and off-peak ridership with our lower fares and shifting people into different time periods and getting additional ridership and then holding that ridership over time. I think this works counter to that with very little in terms of revenue that we generate.
I have that same viewpoint, this was one that I wanted to tinker with and thought, well, maybe it might offer something. But I think it is counterproductive for us because in addition to the revenue piece that we have here, the utilization of our system is, I think, twofold. One, we've talked about the impact of services and what the critical role it plays, but it's also creating an environment for people to use transit and how do we improve the system to make them use it. And looking from the outer areas, many, many more people get introduced to the system by taking those easy trips in. And that's an easy trip when it's free. They become our more adjusted to using transit and grows our system. And you'd have to have a really good number here to go for us to start this, at least at this point in time, when we're also going to put on the table the possibility of reducing services. So I think it's a bit counterproductive and doesn't generate enough for us to really start with this out there.
Thank you, Ms. Hutchins. Any other comments?
There are a couple of other approaches here, and I really do appreciate your concern about the elasticity because I don't want to cut off our nose to spite our face. You know, here, the expression my mother always used. I'm not sure I've understood it. But I think the ridership is really expecting us to be creative, come up with things that are new and effective. You know, that's why I think people have glommed onto the retail and the subway stations. There's been a lot of instantaneous support for them. And I'm wondering, what if we were to limit this just to those lots where there is significant weekend demand? I'd asked you, Mr. Cato, to actually do a survey of how much ridership parking was, or how much parking. We don't know whether they're getting on the subway or not. We just operate free lots on the weekend. We don't know what people are parking there for. They get a weekend of free parking, right? Whether they get on the train or not.
Yes.
But anyway, what did you find in that survey?
Well, we found that, again, 9% utilization system-wide. And what I'm recommending is, if you wish to pursue this further, is for us to do one more weekend and then bring it back station by station. And then we have a much better view of the numbers. To take one weekend and try to determine, does that happen all year, might not be the best approach. We would like to do another weekend surveys and give it to you station by station, the results of the two weekends that we did the survey. and bring that back to the March 6th meeting.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Ms. Hewlett?
I'm sorry, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So right now, you just have the average of 9%?
We have the actuals per station. I don't have it with me right now. Last night, we were trying to put this together. We weren't sure. We got a couple of stations mixed up. We'd like to do it.
That's about 9%, you said?
System-wide.
System-wide, right. Okay.
But I would like to, again, do one more weekend and bring it back station by station.
But there are some, if I could just reclaim my time, there are some stations where they're filling up very well. I mean, the parking lots are filling up on weekends.
There is significant use at several stations.
And so I'm willing to see another week on this to get some data. But could, when you come back, could you give us a couple of other scenarios here that we might look at? What would be the situation if we were to charge $1 and were to do so only at those stations where there was real evidence of demand? Just to, you know, I think the point is, no, to limit the number of lots. I think the point is that I'm not prepared to scoff at $1 million and say, oh, it's so little, we shouldn't be bothered with it. I think we really need additional information in order to make an intelligent.
Mr. Graham, I have no problem with getting additional information. I would note it isn't just $1 million. It's closer to 100,000 or less.
Well, that's not what this shows here.
This doesn't include the number of people who won't ride rail and therefore won't pay the rail revenue.
Well, but we don't
have... include that, but we know that number is probably fairly significant. I would guess it's close to $1 million.
We haven't been advised in that regard.
Well, we were originally, and then they backed off on that. But let me just know. I am fully convinced. You know, we had this argument about elasticity when we talked about fares the last time, and I said that the staff had way overestimated the number of people who wouldn't ride, and it turns out that we had an increase as opposed to a decrease. In this case, I think I understand elasticity reasonably well. I do think we would have a substantial reduction. I definitely will not, and I suspect the entire state of Maryland, you can ask Ms. Hewlett, will not support a parking fee increase on the weekends. Okay?
Well, that kind of forecloses discussions. But you ought to. Can I reclaim my time?
No, Ms. Hewlett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Graham. I take exception to the way it was characterized. That you don't want to scoff at $1 million, and I. Two would not, and I don't know that that's the actual number, and I don't know if the number suggested by Peter Benjamin that we would lose is correct. We don't know the answer to that, but I don't think it's scoffing. I think it's that what we lose, whatever it is, might not be enough to offset the charge. So I think it's not just scoffing at this money; it's balancing the competing interests. And we did raise parking substantially. I personally am willing to hear what the dollar would do, but I can't imagine how much that would bring. And if it's a dollar as opposed to the $2.50 or the $3, and it's limited to those stations where there is demand or particular demand, I don't know what that would bring in. And I just don't know that it would be enough to offset whatever problems it may cause on the flip side. But I'm willing to hear.
Ms. Hutchins, and then Mr. Green.
I think we could bring back as much data as possible, but I do think that what we're looking at is that it is a fare increase. It's a fare increase on many riders. And the riders that we're bringing in are the ones that you want to provide the inducement that they would be part of the system. So I think it's a bit counterproductive. It does, when we look at this number, everybody has to figure out what the million plus means to them. But I think the question is whether or not it's really going to benefit us, and is it counterproductive on those riders that are coming in. It's not that they just simply pay an extra fee, but everybody else is not paying along the way. Their fare goes up. And it's seen throughout their experience, and it doesn't become the inducement to be part of the system. It's only the weekend that we're talking about. we could have a greater discussion about the weekday piece, but the weekend, I'm not sure it merits a starting at this point.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Graham, do you want to speak?
Well, I do. First, let me just kind of make a general comment. I mean, you know, I this is my 10th year on this board, and, you know, and I have found over time that ultimatums don't work. Because everybody here has that card to play. Jeez. Every jurisdiction has that card to play. And, you know, we're dealing here with difficult issues that involve, you know, different interests, and I want to be very respectful, you know, to the interests that you are representing. And I would ask that you be respectful to the interests that I am representing and others are representing from the District of Columbia. But, I mean, if we put out this will not happen, then, you know, the next person can say the same thing.
And I didn't say that, Mr. Graham. I said I will not vote.
I understand. But I think until we have all the information before us to see what's possible here on all of these matters, I think it's best that we try really hard to keep kind of an open mind. I mean, I am interested in raising the parking issue generally because we have done a review of the various parking lots, and we are fine. We can have this reviewed and confirmed by staff because we did this, but the fact of the matter is there are a large number of our parking spaces and parking lots that are full by 8 a.m. on the weekdays. Or by 8:30 a.m. on the weekdays. They're full. That's the report to us. And so I don't know whether we impact any elasticity there by a modest increase in the parking fee. And, but anyway, I don't do this, I don't put this idea on the table to annoy those of you who are against it. You know, that's not my purpose. My purpose is to find money sufficient to close this gap. And I think the parking issues and how much parking costs, and I'm not going to repeat all of the issues around parking and what is free parking and there is no free parking and all of those issues. I won't go into that because we all know them. But there's much more involved here than the budget gap discussion. And the fact that we have 57,000 spaces, mm-hmm. all of which are free for 2 days of the week, you know, raises a question which I think we should at least look at. And I would hope that you would have a sufficiently open mind. I mean, right now, we are looking at very substantial bus service reductions that seriously impact the District of Columbia and its residents. You know, and I haven't said, Mr. Albert hasn't said, well, that we're not going to support that under any circumstance. I mean, I think this discussion will move forward if we're all just a little bit appreciative of the other's viewpoints.
Mr. Graham, we have three people who wish to speak. Mr. Zimmerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'd like to distinguish between a few things in this question. You know, there's an equity argument that has been made. The idea that I'm speaking strictly to the weekend issue here, that there would be something unfair about, in effect, a fare increase for people at the end of the line. I guess I'm less impressed with that argument because it seems to me that those who are parking in the facility at the end of the line are getting a service that people along the line aren't getting. They're not using parking. And in fact, if they're getting other ways, there is a real impact of the choice to drive to the station as opposed to the choice to take the bus or walk to those who do. But I don't really see an equity issue. I think you could turn that around and say there's an equity issue in that we're basically subsidizing people that drive to stations. We're not subsidizing the person who's taking the bus to the station or walking. On the other hand, I think there's a big factual question that Mr. Benjamin was addressing earlier that really is at the heart of whether this would make sense to do. The question is, what is the behavioral impact and what are the revenue implications of that? Now, I am somewhat now confused between what I'm seeing on this slide, what I thought I saw in the materials we received before, and what I heard said. I, too, would not scoff at $1 million. I suspect that no one at this table would scoff at $1 million or two or three. So in revenue terms, you know, if it's on that magnitude, it's interesting just as a, you know, as a budget item. And in this climate, it is certainly something I would look at. The question is, does it net to anything like this? Because at $100,000 or $200,000, it's a lot less interesting as a budget item. It seems like this hinges on, I mean, if I understand this correctly, Mr. Chairman, we're looking at, on this slide, at sort of a gross figure. And that's the best guess, and I think we have to acknowledge that this is somewhat speculative, because it's not a charging, it's not an operation we're charging now, and we're thinking about raising a charge, which by, you inherently know a whole lot more about what's going to happen then. We're in a zero situation, so you have to look at what we think, how many people we think would still park there, what revenue that would bring, what cost it is to administer, and the real question is, how many people would choose not to do it? We're a little bit uncertain about how many people are doing it now because of the fact we're at zero, so there's a lot of uncertainty about this. But the real question for me is, if we charge, how much are we impacting the choice of people to use the system? I heard that alluded to a lot, and I think that is the most important question. If I thought that we were going to discourage a lot of people from using the system on the weekends, and there's a big advantage to it, I mean, the thing we want to do is promote as much ridership off-peak as we can. We all know that, but it bears repeating. You know, peak time, we have capacity problem. Getting people to ride off-peak is net revenue. I mean, those are that actually, you know, every trip is subsidized on average, but every trip is not an average trip. The marginal trip can contribute more than the person is drawing on us in cost. So when somebody rides off-peak, they're actually helping our budget. They're also helping everything else we're trying to do in the region. So my number one consideration in terms of any reluctance to pursue this is, what effect do we have on discouraging people who are now at the outer ends, choosing to get on the family of four who says, I want to go down to the Smithsonian, you know, the couple who wants to go up to U Street and, you know, visit some of the fine establishments in Ward 1. If they choose now to go park and ride the system, you know, what fare is going to discourage them from doing that? That, to me, is what we really need to focus on, because that's the budget issue, but it's also the behavioral issue. Long term, I mean, I have to say, I think the whole concept of free parking is one the United States of America cannot afford. And long term, our children and grandchildren, I don't believe, will know the concept. Parking, of course, isn't free. There's a very good book by a man named Shoup called The High Cost of Free Parking. Parking spaces cost tens of thousands of dollars. They're real resources. They are the most important way in which we subsidize automobile use and thereby subsidize countries around the world that are hostile to us when we have to buy oil. And people haven't really made that connection between all this apparently free good we have and the high cost we're paying in so many other ways. So long term, you're going to pay for parking someday everywhere you go. The real question, though, is how do you get from here to there? Because in an environment in which so much parking is free, every time you look at charging for something, you have to ask the question, well, I could charge for this lot here, but if it's free right next door, I don't necessarily get the results I want. So the ultimate policy goal of eliminating free parking, I think, is questionably where we need to go. And I'm not just talking metro, I'm talking everything. The point is, we don't control everything, we control one thing. And we really have to consider what the steps are, the incremental changes, and what the behavioral effects are of those, and how they affect us. So this becomes a much more difficult question. If we are talking about something in excess of $1 million, then I think it's something we should press staff to really look at to get us some indication, because we shouldn't eliminate the possibility. But I do think we have to proceed with some caution. It's not just a matter of, you know, whose ox is gored, the effect on outer jurisdictions and inner jurisdictions, although that's obviously there and we have to be considerate of that. There is a real question for all of us as to whether this, A, is something that just will get more revenue and help us get through a tough budget year, or B, will have, you know, effects in the short term and medium term that actually would be negative in terms of what we're trying to accomplish, and I think we need to know that.
Thank you, Mr. Zimmerman. Ms. Hutchins and then Mr. Solomon.
I just want to follow up on the analogy that you've used, because I think it's not unknown to those of us who travel from the outer suburbs. It's whether or not someone has an option on the weekend to either park or drive. And they have a great option to drive because guess what? It's not congested. And when they take that choice, and it is a fare passenger, that is, it, will I take the five kids in the car and drive in, or will I put them on the rail and park? And what you want is that they will take that free ride on the weekend, and when they come to the game on Wednesday night, they'll all grab the metro because they've experienced it. And it induces them to see the value of it. I want to speak to equity across the region. Equity doesn't only begin in where the passenger starts or ends. It's their entire trip. It's whether or not they start in the district and end up in the suburbs or vice versa. So we need to be concerned about both of them. I'm concerned about the woman that showed up at the public hearing that happened to have lived in the District of Columbia and worked at the farther end and was concerned about not only the bus, the rail, and the bus that she took to get to work. She was concerned about that entire trip, not where it started, but what comprehensive, what the complete trip meant to her and how that service impacted her life. I think that's the side that we have to look at. The only reason I use it as the passenger piece, we add up the convenience and the cost when we use the system, and that's what the passengers are looking for. I just don't see the revenue enough because the choices are not there on the weekend, and the opportunity to not take the system are there, and that's the part that I think will make the difference. You can get up 66 on Saturdays and Sundays. You can't on the weekend. And if you can drive, people have been induced to drive. We should be in the business of trying to get them to not drive on every opportunity that's out there. And this is a revenue that does not seem to cost give us enough, whether it's $1 million or not. Because I don't think we know the rail impact of what it's going to be. And it does mean that they'll make a decision about the cost of the entire passenger trip for them.
Mr. Solomon.
Yeah, I have to agree with Kathy on this one.
How?
We said we're not going to have fare increases, and every time we have fare increase discussion, this issue comes up. In essence, what this is, even those weekend parking fees, this is a fare increase proposal on long-range haulers. I mean, this is really a fair increase for our customers. No matter how you describe it, this is a fair increase for the long-distance travelers. And if we're going to talk about fair increase, we should put all of the components into the hopper, not just this one component. So either we're going to do fair increase this year, or we're not going to do fair increase this year. And if we're going to do fair increase, then every component should be discussed. That's my point.
Have we finished discussion on this for the time being, and can we move on to Metro Access discussion? Okay.
Did you discuss retail already?
Oh, I'm sorry. Is that in between?
No, it's
It's after.
I thought that was
it's
after.
It's next.
As long as it's on the
after Metro Access.
The next question that the committee asked last week was the Metro Access area and hours currently and exceeding ADA minimum requirements. With the reduction or operating beyond the three-quarter mile corridor around that service area, that actually increases the cost to the service, as well as the fact that we run 19 hours per day. Metro Rail runs only 19 hours per day. We run Metro Access 21 hours. That's not specifically required under the ADA compliance regulations. Also, the nominal supplemental fare charged, $1 for every 3 miles beyond the corridor to a maximum of $4, and then the operating extension service on the weekends. We've assumed that if we actually just meet ADA requirements on those areas, we could potentially reduce the cost to about $2.8 million a year.
I personally find this one extremely difficult to deal with because this is really a difficult choice. Originally, I think when these materials were given to us, there was a $700,000 savings associated with it.
Yes, and the first
substantially.
You're right. And actually, the request was specific to the first bullet regarding the three-quarter mile corridor around the fixed route service. That item actually would reduce the expense to $700,000. When we took another look at it, because of the committee request last week, we actually looked at the fares as well as the extension of service on the weekends and came up to, our vendor came up to an estimate that the average cost per rider was going to be lower, and as a result, we could reduce further cost reductions for the service.
Okay. So are you saying that $700,000 is because of the three-quarter mile and the remainder is because of time of service, the 21 hours?
Time of service, and yes, an extension of service on the weekends. Yes, that's correct.
Okay, it's not associated with anything else. It's really, so the big thing in here is when we provide service.
Yes.
And what would we reduce to? We would go to how many hours if we followed the federal regulations?
I don't know that number actually, because we're waiting on our peer review to confirm some of the assumptions that we have here, which I believe is going to be in March next week.
One of the big concerns I have here is, and if you take a look at one of your earlier tables, you'll see that the state of Maryland subsidy increase is driven very, very heavily by the single factor. We have a $10 or $11 million increase associated with Metro Access Service, which is a federal mandate and which provides very useful and very valuable service, provides mobility for people who otherwise may not have it. So clearly for us, when we are 60% or more of the Metro Access budget, this is a very attractive potential savings. On the other hand, I'm very, very reluctant to ask somebody in a wheelchair to wheel their chair 2 miles in order to get to our closest stop or pay an increased fee associated with that distance even more than what they're already paying, or worse yet, leaving them at home on weekends so that they can't do things that otherwise they would want to do. So it's a very, very, very difficult choice here. This is a really critical mobility function for some people who may not have any other alternative. And on the other hand, it is costing us an enormous amount of money in the state of Maryland. So I must admit, I don't know what the answer on this one is. And I think the other big user of Metro Access is the district. So, Mr. Graham?
Yeah, I think you've stated that extremely well, in the quandary that we're in here. I would only add that as part of the fiscal challenge here is not only what we're facing now, but it's the way in which this whole system is burgeoning and increasing. And our projections in terms of those increases are also part of what we have to deal with. Because if we could, Mr. Benjamin, if we could freeze this now and said this is going to cost us, we're going to forego $2.8 million savings for the next 5 years, if for each of the next 5 years, it would be a different situation. But the point of fact, you know, this is going to be increasing by all indications. Am I right or am I wrong?
That's correct.
And so I think, here again, I think we need more information, Mr. Benjamin. And the information that I would request is I'd like to know real life, and we don't have to have a hearing on this, but I'd like to know real life what the impact of that this is. You mentioned two examples. If you could flesh that out for me so that I could have a better idea of what we're doing with, I'd like to know that. I would also like to know what other jurisdictions have done with this unfunded federal mandate in terms of these issues. And if you can take, I mean, I think it's always helpful to look and see how others are wrestling with this. If you could give us 10 other transit systems, to say how, what have they done? Have they exceeded the federal requirements such as we have done? Are they, you know, let us have that experience. Okay. That would help me. Maybe others have additional information they would like, but that would help me in dealing with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as I said before, for Maryland, this is a very, very sensitive subject, because if you look back at one of those earlier tables, you'll see that our subsidy goes up $16 million from last year to this year. 11 of the 16 is this. Two-thirds of the increase is associated with Metro Access. So for us, this is a big concern, yet we are very, very concerned also about what is our primary function here and who do we need to serve and who are we leaving stuck at home or who can't get to a place that they critically need to go. So I'm not quite sure how we solve that particular problem.
We'll provide that information. The peer review is actually next week, and we'll have all of those components of what Mr. Graham requested. We'll have that for the committee.
Shall we move on to retail and metro, or are there any other comments on this one?
The committee also asked about retail in the metro. We provided in the appendix of the materials that you have a white paper that speaks to this issue. I think the overall point here is that the private companies that responded to requests to look at this have made the statement that they don't think it would be a profitable venture for them to have retail at our stations unless they were able to sell food and beverages. And our board policy prohibits that, but that's the information that we have currently.
Mr. Zimmerman?
I found this a little bit frustrating going back to when we first asked for this a couple of years ago or whatever. And
4 years.
Well, how many years ago it was, now we're having to come back, and it's just thinking was a little bit more, a little clearer than what we received. When I got materials back, we said, what did we discover about retail, and you know, could we make some money there? We got there's something back that says that the result was the consensus from the larger retail operators and other transit agencies was that the most desired financially lucrative transit retail use is a new stand that includes the sale of food and beverages. Fine. That isn't the question I asked. I asked, and I think the board asked, can we make some money on retail? You know, including obviously the things that we don't currently outlaw. I mean, it's an interesting question to ask about food. It's legitimate to talk about, but is the conclusion, which is not stated here, although I think we just heard Ms. Gisel say it, that there's just no money to be made at all if we don't sell food and allow food into our system? Is that really what you think?
That's correct. Yes.
Is that on the basis of the work that was done a few years ago, or?
It's on the basis of that work and the response that we had actually received from some of the participants who we reached out to.
There's just no interest in selling anything to people in the rail system, the 800,000 people who, you know, go in and out every day, except to sell them stuff to eat.
The interest is in newspapers, except that they don't want to see competitive newsstands, but primarily it's food.
I understand people are real anxious to sell food. Money is made in selling food to people. I get that. Is there no money to be made selling anything else?
Well, no, that's not what we're saying. In fact, what we're prepared to do is to put together what we call a mobile retail program, which would be exploring the potential for retail for things like florists, mobile dry cleaning pickup, gourmet food to take home for dinner, that kind of thing. That was an item that we were preparing to bring to the board for approval to initiate an RFP this spring.
Was that in this material?
No, it is not.
You received a memo from the general manager in December providing this information and stating that we were...
It's in the appendix, actually, the memo that Bodenhaber is referring to.
I guess I must have missed the appendix. I'm sorry, but... that's the question. It seems like people want to sell stuff. You know, people get chased away because they're setting up tables all over the place to sell people gloves and hats and scarves and umbrellas. Right. So, I mean, it just intuitively seems like somebody wants to sell people stuff. Now, you know, it might turn out there's not a lot of revenue in that, and it might not be. I'm not someone who thinks we're going to solve our budget problems this way. On the other hand, the original discussion of this was not principally to make money. It was to provide an amenity to our riders to make their lives easier. And I'm for doing it for that reason, if we could do it without losing money. So, I mean, if we could just let small vendors sell some things that would be useful to our riders, I'd be for doing that if it didn't cost us any money to do. If it turns out it also makes some money, if it winds up creating a market that then the big folks want to come in and bid on and actually does help our budget, gee, that'd be great. But it does seem to me like this is something that got pushed a lot and just dropped, and the board never heard.
Twice.
What happened and why? Now, most of you weren't in your jobs, you know, the earlier time.
Right.
But I feel like we're stuck back where we were, and you know, I'm personally not real interested in reopening the discussion about bringing food into the system, because I think there's all kinds of reasons why most of our riders would strongly oppose that. I don't think the management here would support it. I don't think the board would ultimately approve it. There's a lot of good reasons not to have food running around our system. But it does seem to me that there's still the potential that we could do something on retail.
And
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there other comments on this one?
Mr. Vice Chair?
Well, I think the gentleman, he wants to respond.
Well, I just wanted to say on the bar right now is an item for April to initiate RFP for mobile vending. And so one of the things we're working on right now is we've been working with our operations folks to identify locations within the system where it's operationally feasible for us to dedicate space for these mobile vending opportunities. So that will be coming to you shortly.
Mr. Lynn.
I would be interested in seeing the scope of that and what you're thinking about in terms of mobile vending. I know someone had approached me a couple of years ago about some services that could be provided that might constitute mobile vending, like some car services that might be available in garages and things like that they could provide, and some revenue sharing opportunities for that. So I was just wondering what would be the scope of this and how you would find the RFP so that it would have a wide net.
I think it'll be anything that's not excluded by our current exclusions, and that's one of the issues for us with operations is how much space would we be able to dedicate to these kinds of things. If you're going to have a pickup for automobile repair or oil changes, for example, that would obviously require some operating space that's currently dedicated to kiss and ride or taxis or so on. The same thing for a cart that would be drop-off dry cleaning. We would need to be dedicating space to that, comparable to the way we're treating Zipcar, but we would just need to come to some kind of understanding of how we were going to balance those kinds of uses.
Sure, I understand that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Graham.
Yeah, I just want to share Mr. Zimmerman's frustration, because having been involved in this initially, this goes back years now. And the fact of the matter, Mr. Cato, we have twice gone out with an RFP. Not once, but twice. And now we're preparing a new RFP, which gives a lot of opportunity for those who adore planning spend another period of time agonizing over these issues. And what also concerns me is I've been back and forth on this issue via email with the staff. And the fact of the matter is that in 2007, we got responses that didn't involve any food at all. And I have yet to be answered on the question of why weren't they considered? Why weren't they brought to us? Why weren't they analyzed? Because we've got a group of people here, probably a lot of small businesses, anxious for an entrepreneurial opportunity, that have been just kind of snuffed out. And so this is the third time we go out. And I am equally mystified as to what's going on here, because we don't seem to, this is one of those things where we feel like we're pulling a donkey up a hill. You know, you don't want to go, but we want to go. You know what I'm saying? I want to go. Let me just speak for myself. I want to go up this hill. I want to allow these opportunities. And I know that the food is a huge controversy. Were you telling me, Mr. Cato, about the rat problem in the New York subway? Did that come from you or someone else? That there's no.
It came from an article from the New York.
And so we don't like the specter of that at all. But surely there are things that we could be doing here. And I think Mr. Zimmerman makes an excellent point about services, but also there's a revenue potential and a benefit for small business. It just is really important. So, Mr. Cato, can you assure us that you're at least getting some of our enthusiasm for this?
Mr. Cato.
Yeah, so I hate to be seen as a donkey, so I will make sure.
It's a very good symbol these days.
We will bring a comprehensive one back, and we will give you specific recommendations. There are people selling merchandise on the system because we trace them off almost every day, and so if we can do that, concerning food, there are other transit properties that allow people to sell food at the top of the entry, but they can't bring it into the system. That would take some enforcement, but we will bring back every option this time to the board.
Do we have a revenue estimate for 10?
We do not have a. We estimated if we were able to sell food in the kiosks at 8 stations downtown, we estimated it wouldn't be exceed $1 million. So we believe it would be less than $1 million, but we don't have any revenue estimates that have been offered.
Well, let me try to put in $500,000.
That would be reasonable.
Well, let me try to summarize where I think we are at this point. I believe that the board has made its feelings known well to the staff. I think the staff has responded that we will be moving in this area. I must admit that I don't think that we could reasonably expect any significant amount of revenue by the time you got done, since you don't even know what it is that you're advertising for at this point. Are you willing to put a number in the budget for revenue for this item? Is there a proposal there to do that?
I would recommend not at this time, but I do commit that we will actually look at some of the RFP that's actually currently in process and incorporate some other, you know, trends in retail and what other transit industries are doing. We will incorporate those as much as we can and see if we can accelerate that process to get responses back and then look at it.
So we're looking at potential revenue in 2011, but at this point, is staff willing to say that there is revenue that we can put into this budget right now?
Mr. Cato. Mr. Chair, if I might, there are so many risks that we have in the budget today. I would rather go ahead and do the analysis, bring it back. If we determine there's revenue, then we amend the budget to show the additional revenue. There's many things, as you have said, that we have expenses that need to be covered, and I would like to do it that way, but I am making that commitment.
Okay, and we can also distribute the scope of work that we'd be bringing in April. That has been prepared. Right now, as I said, the issue is identifying the operational feasibility issues, if any, and so we can share that scope. We would be prepared, and I think, to make an award by June and have something in place by July if we went forward starting in April.
Can we move on to the next item?
I don't think so. But
Ms. Kissel, next item.
Yes, next item. We were asked actually to look at our current revenue, our current contract that we have for advertising. Currently, we prohibit the advertising of advertisements for alcohol on our Metro Rail and Metro Bus. We had done a cursory check with our contractor to understand if we included alcohol, what that would potentially drive in revenue, and these are the preliminary estimates that we received. If that's where it is. So we'd have to modify the contract and actually get the committee to agree to advertise alcohol on our system.
Let me just ask the members of the committee, is there any interest in pursuing this area? It's another revenue area.
No.
I don't see much interest in that one. Okay. Let's continue.
And actually, one of the last, at least follow-up items, before we then get into discussion of the service changes, was just information on the articles that we had gotten from the Washington Post that talked about recommended changes from our writers, and we just listed that in the appendix.
Where is that? On what page?
Mr. Gene Cullen.
Can I ask you a question? That's it? That's all we got?
I'm sorry?
That was it? That's all we heard?
Yeah, currently that was what I received, and that was from Dr. Gridlock.
I can't believe that's all that was said. You know?
We checked. There was actually some blogs that we were checking on. That's all I received.
So. Okay. He's right behind you. You can ask him. Whether that's it. Okay. Finally, the... Okay. Want to go to the next?
On the following chart, actually, this is... there was a request on the administrative organizational changes.
There was a request to... list all positions that were added, new positions in the FY10 budget, FY9 budget, I'm sorry. These are the list and the title and the rationale for those positions. I don't know how much detail you want me to go to in each position, but I did list the why we did this, what the changes were. In some cases, there were not a net add of positions. We just took positions and created these specific jobs. And so, Mr. Chair, it depends upon how much detail you went on this. We have the detail attached.
I'm satisfied, Mr. Graham.
Well, I had asked for this information. Okay. Let me just be clear. Are these new jobs that you've created in 10?
Yes. Some of these are new jobs. They are new jobs. In some cases, they are jobs that were restructured. In other cases, they're new jobs, and we communicate that, and we state in the rationale which jobs were new jobs and which ones were positions that we restructured.
We didn't have a director of Metro Access?
No, it's the director of eligibility certification. That was, and we have an action on that today, too, at the board meeting. We proposed to bring that service in-house. and we added staff to do the eligibility for our customers who utilize or proposing to use the access services. As part of that approval of the staff, it included a director of certification when we proposed the '09 budget. And so that was added as part of the budget itself. And so, again, since it occurred in the past 6 months, just to comply with your request, I listed that here. The eligibility was done externally with an outside firm, and they're still doing part of it because we've not fully staffed up for that.
Is this person going to assume all that responsibility?
The person, ultimately? It was 11 positions that the board approved to do the eligibility. And I'm going to ask Kristen and Kent to go into more detail. We have began the process of hiring those people. We wanted to get the director first so that that individual could make the decisions on the individuals. What we've done is we've reduced the amount that we're spending with the external organization that's currently performing this services for us. And so there's a staffing up and a decrease in expenditures. The intent is this will make it easier for our customers to determine if they're eligible, but it also makes it a far more effective way of determining that we have total control of it.
And when will our contractor be out of this business altogether?
Mr. Graham, I don't think that's something that would happen altogether at any stage, because there's always a need for some consultation with people who have the physical therapist, occupational therapist expertise. But by enhancing the skills of our in-house staff, we're going to reduce the number of people who have to go for that level of assessment. So that's why today's...
Can I get some numbers on that?
Yes.
To show just what the diminution is in the contract.
Yes.
Now, I'd also like to see, if this is part of what I was aiming at, Mr. Benjamin, is that what we are finding, what we found out here and what we knew previously in this case, I guess, is that we have this one position, but then we have 11 others. So this represents 12. And I think we need to dig down a little bit for that type of information on all the others as well, because each of these directorships may or may not involve additional further staff enhancements. And I'd like to know what all of that is.
I understand what you're asking for.
Right.
Are you asking for cost information associated with
that? Well, I guess it's not what we're doing. I mean, because did you send out layoff notices last week?
In fact, we laid off people this week.
This week. How many did you send out?
Well, we sent out a total of 100. It was about 100 notices. 40 people have left the agency. And over the next month or so, the remainder will leave.
And what is the gross number of new positions that we're creating in these few pages?
I don't have those numbers in front of me, but the net to the organization is a reduction of 100 positions, the net.
The net.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Graham, can I recognize Ms. Hutchins?
Yes, I wasn't quite finished, but I'll pause.
Okay. Ms. Hutchins?
Well, I think, Mr. Graham, I'm simply trying to clarify the question that you've asked, as well as the data that you're looking back. And I would hope that when it comes back to you, it would give us a table, and it would tell us the number of positions now and whether they've been reclassified or additional positions asked. Because the question, first of all, I'd like to just say this, and then I'll give it back to you, Mr. Graham. It's really hard when you're going through here and you don't reiterate what the question was that was asked. Would be nice to say it was
okay,
asked.
What was the question?
And what was the question? But I would agree with Mr. Graham's data that he's trying to get back, because the information isn't complete, and I think that table would give us.
Mr. Graham.
I think what is concerning me here, and I'm not voicing opposition, don't get me wrong, but what's concerning me here is that we have a significant enhancement at the executive level, simultaneous with a significant reduction elsewhere. And some of the reduction is in the executive level, but without more information, it's really hard to figure this out. I mean, this doesn't give me enough to really feel comfortable with what's going on here. Because if each one of these positions meant another 11 new jobs to come with them, which I'm sure is not the case, you know, that would obviously be something I couldn't support. I mean, as much as we've given you broad discretion in terms of these staff decisions, in the light and in the context of layoffs, you know, I really must ask these questions.
Let me make sure, for point of clarification, we will bring back not only the impacts of these specific positions, but did that create additional positions? But on the other side, I have to show you what we reduced and the number of directors that were reduced in the organization, so you can see the net.
And the number of reductions at this level?
Yes, at this level.
At this level?
At this level.
Okay. Well, how long do you think, Mr. Chairman, it would be for us to get that in?
We have a meeting scheduled for March 6th. We can include that. On 5th, I'm sorry. We can include that as part of the package.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Zimmerman.
So you'll be getting us before the next meeting, basically.
Yes.
Next week. Something that shows the overall effect on administrative positions.
Yes.
I would ask, I'd be interested in seeing something, at least in terms of characterizing that as best you can, going back 2 years, because I believe you started doing things the day you started here.
Yes.
And I'd like to get a picture of what's happened to the administrative apparatus, reduced positions, and things like that for the last 2 years.
And I do have a report out that talks about organizational management incentives that includes part of that, but I can break it down into a matrix.
Yeah. Mr. Linton?
Well, let me just say, I think we were very clear when the general manager was hired that we were focusing on goals and objectives that we expected his team to achieve, and we gave him some latitude in terms of his organization. And I think we also recently have gone through an evaluation with consultants to come in to look at how our organization was structured so that we can, in fact, have some efficiencies. It seems to me that if, in fact, within the context, he has done an organizational reorganization that has, one, provided us with efficiencies, stayed within his operating budget, and if he has offsets as a result of some of those changes, and we're moving towards our goals and objectives, it seems to me that's what we as a management team would want to achieve. So if in that context that's what he's providing us with data that supports that, I think that's moving in the right direction.
Mr. Giancola.
Yeah, let me just add, I was more interested in the next page, the Director of Emergency Management. And when I read the rationale, and don't get me wrong, I think this is a very important position. I'm kind of curious. It says we didn't have any internal expertise, and applied we didn't previously have any internal expertise, and yet I've been with enough government organizations that everybody seems to have internal folks that have expertise in this area through training and whatever. So are you really saying you never really had any internal expertise? And so I'm just concerned about the way it was written. And then also, I assume this new role is better coordinating among all the other operating divisions, emergency management techniques and training. So can you talk about that a little bit? And are you actually providing more training for our personnel in that area?
Yes, we are, but I would like to bring it back as part of the comprehensive package. And it did not, I'm sorry that it implies that we had no internal expertise. That's not what I meant. It's a wording that said we needed expertise. We needed additional expertise in that area. But we will bring it back with more information. And in addition, Mr. Chair, I did pass out the impact statements on 64 positions, where cuts that we're making, it's a total of 300 and something positions that we're talking about eliminating as part of the $81 million. Our request was, what is the impact on services? And so we have a matrix that talks about the positions as well as the what the impact statements are. And that was a request made at the last meeting. I think just handed out to you.
I think, once again, the staff has made some requests that the, I'm sorry, the board has made some requests that the staff is responding to, and we will get that information shortly. We have one more page which has to do with the schedule for service reductions. And I think that's sort of obvious that we're under a very tight schedule for you to be able to do what you need to do. I'd like to make a proposal to the committee, if that's acceptable to the committee. Could you switch back to page 4 in this presentation, please? I think page 4 is a very good summary of where we are. We started out with a $154 million budget gap. We reduced that to $29 million. And on page 4, we see how much of that $29 million each jurisdiction would have to deal with in order to not have an increase in their subsidy. In many cases, those numbers are low enough that it is possible that with some modest increases in subsidy and or some modest changes in service entirely within that jurisdiction and not affecting other jurisdictions, we might in fact be able to get ourselves to a point where we have a budget that we can afford. And the question I have for all of you is, would you be willing to accept those numbers, looking at each one of the numbers as they show up, for instance, about $5 million for the district, about $16 million for Maryland, et cetera, and see whether you could accommodate those entirely within either increases you think you could afford or local service decreases. If that is possible, we could, or if we can at least get fairly close with that, we could, 1 week from now, go to public hearing with whatever service decreases there were that were in fact localized to each individual jurisdiction, and I suspect some jurisdictions may not need any.
Sure.
Is that a possibility, Mr. Zimmerman?
Yes.
Okay.
Arlington would be prepared to do that.
Okay, and if everybody could examine that, we may be very, very close to an answer without struggling with some of the other issues that we have been struggling with. Clearly, if we can get broad cuts in the budget, those are still things we want to do, but we are within pretty close striking range. Mr. Graham.
Well, may I just get some clarity on this? Is the state of Maryland suggesting that it can come forward with an additional $16 million?
What we're saying
is
we...
kind of, you know, in the context of prior messages, this is kind of new. It has a new feeling to it.
What we're saying is
a very intriguing one if it's accurate.
What we're saying is we would like to work at a combination of increased subsidy if that's possible and trims to service that don't have substantial effects that could bring us within the range and ones that would occur either entirely or primarily within the state of Maryland.
But the point I'm trying to make, just because maybe others see this clearly and it's only me that doesn't, is that all of the messages we've gotten to this point in time has been absolutely no subsidy increase. Various members of this board have taken particular pains to send this message, and so...
That has not been the message from the state of Maryland.
It has not been.
No, it has not been.
I see.
We, in fact, submitted a budget to our legislature that did have an increase.
To the tune of $16 million?
No. But enough so that part of this can be covered and another part can be covered with...
How much would be covered under the...
I don't want to discuss all of those pieces yet. We need to. Our legislature is still in session.
Oh, I see. Well,
I could speak for the executive branch of the district government. Not necessarily for the legislative branch, which Mr. Graham represents, but we're grappling with our own budget challenges, and I would be hard-pressed to recommend to the mayor that we come up with $5 million in new subsidies. Willing to take a look at it, but only in the context of my earlier conversation about looking at perhaps accessing, some of the stimulus dollars that are available to Metro today. I think we can go back, Mr. Graham, and talk to our respective bosses. He does have a boss, by the way. and be able to report back to you by the 5th.
May I suggest also, one of the things we discovered as we looked at some of the proposals, Mr. Graham and Mr. Albert, if I could talk to the two of you, please. One of the things we discovered as we went through some of the proposals made by the general manager and also made by some of our own staff and looking at our bus services was that there were some things that we could trim that would not have substantial effects, but that would start to bring us into alignment. If you could look at that as well, that would be really, really helpful, because that may, in fact, solve our problem.
Absolutely. We're not opposed to looking at kind of reducing duplication in services. We've already started looking at that internally as a means of actually bringing some structural balance to the district's portion of the metro system. So we're putting that on the table. But at this point in time, we're not prepared to say that we're going to that we can afford an increase in our sub today.
I think so too. We're not willing to let go of the use of stimulus, you know, money. Well, we're not willing. I know you're against that, but we're not. Mm-hmm. And so I don't. Our view is that Mr. Albert expressed it earlier, I think accurately, is that a portion of the stimulus money should certainly be used to offset this. And he might not go the full $30 million, but I'm much closer to using the full $30 million. So if this idea is representative of the point of view that we should not use the stimulus for this purpose, then I think there'd be some issues with that.
I think we want to see how far we can get. Ms. Hudgens and Mr. Yule. I think we'd like to hear what you have to say about this, too.
Well, I think the question you have on the table is just to answer how broadly do we, how well, let's put it the other way, how close we can come in terms of dealing with the deficits that are expressed here and what options we might use. And I think that's something that I don't have an answer for right now, but I think the question of going back and looking at that and seeing how that would occur.
Mayor Yule? Thank you.
Before I respond to the question, I need to, and I apologize, but I need to see how we've gotten the budget gap down from $3.8 million to 28.8 or around $40 million to $29 million. How did we find it? Where did the $11 million come from?
Which 11 are you looking at?
Well, last meeting, February 19th, we were looking at a $40 million budget gap. And today it's $29 million.
Yes, I can actually give you the changes that was prepared from the last committee meeting. Of the $44 million, we came down $44 million, and $1.2 million of it was revenue from the fiber optics. We increased that revenue. $5 million of it was revenue from the elimination of paper transfers. We increased our estimate from, it was $5 million, we increased it another $5 to $10 million. $4 million was a decrease in expenses from the GASB 45 health retirement liability. We are not going to fund, we're only going to fund $1 million of that to set up versus $5 million, so that was $4 million. Another $5 million was a reduction in expense due to purchased services. We lowered our estimate on purchased services. Another $10 million was money that we are actually using for preventive maintenance, moving those capital to operating to cover those preventive maintenance expenses. And then $7 million was related to smoothing in some of our pension, going from a three-year to a five-year, consistent with other jurisdictions. And then an additional $12 million less expenses was a result of estimates that we're going to have on wage settlements that we anticipate receiving by the end of this fiscal year. And if you total all those up, expenses and offsetting revenue, you get to $44 million. And as a result, we've taken the $73 million off down to a $28.8 million budget gap, which is where we are at today.
Mr. Yule?
That's fine, and I certainly remember that discussion, I guess last week, whenever it was, but I think that type of analysis should be carried forward. The page we have, page 2 of 20, you know, it's just a number, but it doesn't show how we got there. The week before, we had that analysis, and I just think that it just helps to, you know, keep things apples to apples. Now, to get to the question.
You have about $1 million.
It would be hard for us to find. It would be hard for us to find.
Even with service reductions?
All of the above.
Okay. Mr. Lund.
I was just intrigued by the ability that what we did, what we were able to do to find some additional reductions in our deficit, and particularly with the movement of the capital dollars into preventive maintenance, about $10 million. The one question I would ask is your thinking that some of the stimulus money would in fact replace some of that capital reduction that occurred as a result of moving money into the preventive maintenance? Would some of the stimulus would allow that, allow you to place some of that?
It could replace it, but the 10 million, our thoughts were that that has to be a continuous reduction.
Right.
We were looking at that as coming out of the allocation that we receive every year. And the stimulus monies, we had a list of projects. So in one sense, they can backfill on one side, but we didn't really look at it that way. We did it independent of the stimulus package.
Sure.
And then the stimulus monies are separate.
Sure, I understand that. But in terms of, but you still have, you're deferring some capital as a result of making that preventive maintenance change. And your capital budget, your capital needs have always exceeded what's available, and the stimulus to some degree is to help you get at to that deferred maintenance, those issues you haven't been able to get. What I'm trying to suggest is that as a result of the stimulus, that is backfilling some of that that removal. And I think I'm just trying to say that, you know, in some ways we're capturing some of the stimulus in the budget by the movement to preventive maintenance.
I think your point is a very valid one, and that is that we've already done $10 million of stimulus for this coming year, and if you want to call it capital money or stimulus money, it's one and the same because it's the shortfall is identical either way. So part of what the district has been asking for is already happening. It just depends on how you want to label it. The net effect is that our capital program will be short another $10 million per year, essentially forever, and within the 10-year program, that's $100 million worth that we moved over already.
Yeah. Yes, and that's the point I'm trying to make, is that, you know, we have actually captured some of our reductions as a result of the ability to backfill some of our capital needs with some stimulus money.
Yes, sir.
And that's relieved some of the money that's been used for preventive maintenance.
Absolutely.
I created preventive maintenance. I know what that means.
Mr. Graham.
Yeah, I just on to the issue of the bus service reductions. I want to try to maintain this as a regional discussion, but I have to say that the District of Columbia finds this about as unacceptable as it could be. The impact on DC riders, the impact on bus service within the District of Columbia. We're now analyzing this, and by next time we'll have a real discussion. We'll be able to have a real discussion of what those impacts are. But I think a hint of all of that is presented by the fact that if the bus service reductions that are on the table right now were to be implemented, DC would have a $2.9 million subsidy credit. Mm-hmm. And this is the type of credit that we don't want. Mm-hmm. We don't want it. Because each one of those dollars represents a loss of service that may be significant. We're not sure at this point because we don't have enough detail, but a loss of service that is very significant in terms of the bus riders, and for that matter, there's some rail as well. And so this prospect is very, and I'm speaking on behalf of our delegation, you know, is very troubling to us. And I hope that next time, next time certainly that we'll have some real information about what these cuts would mean for bus riders.
Mr. Graham, in what I was saying, I was not suggesting that you in any way accept the proposals by staff.
I'm making a separate statement, separate from that.
So you would never have that positive
stimulus discussion. Well, but we have all of this left on the table at the moment. I just wanted to be clear about our view on that.
The most difficult thing I think I heard was Mary Ewell's comment that he doesn't think he can make up that $1 million even with service adjustments. If so, that means we have to find cuts that are much, much larger than $1 million in the entire budget in order to get that $1 million to go away, just because of the way the formulas work.
But we're running out of time.
Right. Mr. Solomon.
A quick follow-up to what Mr. Graham said. Prince George's County is having a difficult time accepting staff's analysis with respect to cuts, service cuts. I mean, on the appendix that was mailed out to us, there was a question of bus service cuts in the county and widening headways, and it just looks like the county is being beat up on. We have one of the most transit-dependent set of customers in the county, and it looks like we're being picked on in terms of service cut. We need more, not less. And Mr. Benjamin said we can trim some of these things. I'm very interested in, and we'll have this discussion amongst ourselves, but what that trimming really means in terms of, is it a big slice or a small slice, and how that's going to affect all of the customers in the county and region wide. When we look at these subsidies proposals, I mean, $16 million in Prince George's County, given the citizen taxes and how this money is raised and generated and go to the state budget, generates a lot of money, generate more money than Montgomery County. So we're talking about a lot of money, we're talking about a lot of impact for the county, so the county is very interested in this particular subject matter.
Mr. Lynn.
Okay, well, we'll have an offline discussion, Mr. about that. I just want, you know, I think I understand Mr. Graham's concern about the magnitude of the service cuts, and I think, you know, we all kind of share into that, because I think it's important to recognize that, you know, one of the things that we try to do is try to look at what our existing bus services that are operated by the counties and how they overlap and what impact those service cuts would have also in the regional metro service cuts. And if you put all that in context, in the ride-on service that the county provides in Montgomery County, it's also providing substantial service cuts that, you know, we are already providing a number of service cuts within ride-on. So I think you have to look at, in the totality, the impact on bus riders, and it's not something that we want to do as well. But we all find ourselves in these constraints that require us to, in fact, do that. And I think that's what we're operating in. It's not trying to disenfranchise any particular group. It's not trying to put any more burden on anyone than others. So we try to equally apply that. But we all understand that it's tough times, and we have to make some adjustments somewhere.
I think one of the things that's critical here is the schedule that the staff has put before us, and that says that if, in fact, we want to even consider service cuts that would be effective for the entire year, next fiscal year, it's something that would need to go to public hearing, or we'd need to start that process in early March. That doesn't mean that we have to make those service adjustments, but it says we at least have to be talking with the public about that possibility. I've said since the very beginning that our most important function here is to provide mobility, and so the idea of cutting service is anathema. It's not something you want to do. On the other hand, to the degree that we can get to the point that we can afford the subsidy with service cuts that do not have substantial effects upon our riders and that provide the opportunity for essentially all services that are out there to stay there, that maybe become slightly less convenient, that may be the best way to solve our subsidy problem. So I'd like to at least look at that as one alternative, put that out to hearing to whatever degree we can solve problems so that we don't have to make any of those cuts. That's exciting. That's the way we ought to be. But next week is sort of our deadline for doing that. Mr. Zimmerman, Ms. Hewlett, Mr. Graham.
Briefly, you know, you heard my speech on this last week, so I won't give it to you again, but I will remind you of it, that I believe that widening bus headways, which are usually not good anyway, is exactly the wrong way to go. I think that whether you do that on, you know, you do them on the infrequently, the less ridden routes, and you just basically kill them, you might as well eliminate them. On the other hand, a lot of what we saw on the list that Mr. Graham was reacting to, and I share his view of that, not only for the proposed cuts that would be in my jurisdiction, but from the ones I know of routes I take in the District of Columbia, these are some of the best routes. They're heavily ridden. The buses, in many cases, are full. I just think that's not something we ought to be doing at all. I evinced a willingness at your original proposal because we're close enough that I think we can make it, we can swing it in my jurisdiction without impacting the service. I realize other jurisdictions have different situations, but I do think it should be our collective objective not to degrade the service. I think it would just be a big mistake. At this point we're on now, where the public is so dependent on the service, the demand is growing, to begin diminishing it and essentially restarting that whole cycle downward that we did for so long, that we've come out of, I just think it would be a good thing.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Hewlett, and then Mr. Graham.
Thank you. I have to concur, but thankfully we have 1 week. It's not a lot of time, but it's some time for us to fine-tune this even more before we go to public hearing. I have to concur with Mr. Solomon on some of the routes in Prince George's County, because widening the headway for some of them is tantamount to an elimination of service. And they are, at least a couple of them that we looked at, are actually very heavily traveled bus routes. So, we realize this was put together with good intentions and whatnot, but it does need to be tweaked. And as I understand, it took a very, very long time to even get us to the point where we had 60-minute headways. And to take it beyond that, it's an impossibility.
Sorry, it's not a bus service.
Yeah. So we do need to revisit that, and we will be working internally within the week.
Yeah.
Mr. Graham?
I just have two questions. Do we have any revenue estimate for increased advertising within the system? Is there anything in there as an enhancement?
The only enhancement that we had was the one on alcohol that I think the committee decided they did not want to
pursue. So the flat screens and the projected advertisements, are they already incorporated into our anticipated budget?
Under the contract that was amended, I believe this year or last calendar year, increased revenues by $3 million. We expanded the ability for CBS to expand its ads, and that has already been included in the budget itself. And what they're finding is that, there's a limited market there. The corporations are spending less on advertising, and as a result, there's a limited capacity for them. And we have a guarantee under the existing contract, but there is no real increase in monies coming in other than that what was approved last year.
In terms of the alcohol advertising, I know that was passed earlier. Was there an estimate of what the revenue would be?
$500,000.
And my last question is, what did the current FY10 budget estimates assume about balance transfers?
We assumed for FY10 the $10 million that the committee recommended. We had originally had $5 million, and the committee directed us to increase it by $5
million. Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was talking about elimination of paper transfers. That was not your question. I apologize. It was balance transfer. One moment.
That was the one where we had a reduction because of the fact that the local jurisdictions picked up some.
Right. I think it was. And we have it in the actually, it's built in, and we have it in our FY10 budget. It's a $4.5 million revenue loss, which we have actually assumed. Yeah. Apologize.
But it's in the budget.
Yes.
Mr.
Yule.
Yeah. Just another question. The $29 million service reductions. City of Alexandria, regards to the closed station mezzanines, it says zero impact to the city, but isn't there an impact? Is that a typo?
I think that might be a rounded number. We can go back and look in detail. There is an impact. I think the overall savings and closing of the mezzanines, if I recall,
it's seven,
off the top of my head, like 700,000.
Right.
And so there is an impact. I suspect it was rounded. We can go back and give you
like
the exact
rounding
numbers. Okay.
Mr. Yule, I did want to again say that in the proposal that I'm suggesting, I'm not agreeing to anything
that the staff proposed.
Sure.
We're saying, our starting point is, yeah, you can look at that, and you think there's something there that affects your jurisdiction only, and you want to try and suggest it, that would be fine.
That's fair.
But can we, in fact, find some way to balance this? Because we are awfully close at this point, and the question is, can we make it? And if not, can we at least start the process for hearings while we're trying to do the other cuts so that we don't get ourselves in a bind without unduly exciting our customers with proposals that we otherwise might not want to do at all? Ms. Hutchins, did you want to say something?
No, I just wanted to say that really we're saying that we really want to clarify, I think, for the public that what we're doing is setting the envelope for a public hearing. And we're deciding how, if we accept that, how we would deal with it. But it's the envelope of the public hearing, and if we can come up with something better, we will deal with it better. But it doesn't limit us as to what we can do.
Right. And the objective is always to listen to the public. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a hearing. So this is not a fait accompli. These are proposals that we could put out and we might consider, but we would want to hear what the public has to say about them. If there are no more comments, we are late for our board meeting, and I would call this meeting to an end.